My son, fear Jehovah and fear thou the king. With those who would alter, do not share a thing, for their final cause surely hastens to rise and to their destruction. Now who may be wise? Our daily scripture for today, that was from Proverbs chapter 24, verses 21 and 22 of the 2004 version of Yours Truly, Little Children. That was our scripture for today. Trojan War, chapter 9, we're at paragraph 3 now. The dating of Jericho, as discussed already, has shown consistency with the date of 1452 for conquest by Israel, that is, or 1493 for the Exodus, which is 40 years and some months earlier, and both are lunar aligned independently. Yeah, because we have Moses' death as a lunar aligned date also at the time of very close to the conquest of the Promised Land in 1452. So it's the same year even that we have that alignment with the death of Moses on Adar 7, which was a Sabbath according to Jewish tradition. So if we don't believe all of Jewish tradition, for example, we don't believe their calendar for giving the date of the destruction of Jerusalem, because that's radically different from what is believed. Maybe the conventional dating is wrong, but it's strongly believed by virtually all scholars, apart from maybe Jewish rabbis, that Jerusalem was destroyed in 587. And there are a few other groups who are exceptional cases in their extreme chronologies or different chronologies. But 587 is the date of the destruction of Jerusalem, most people think. And I mean, I'm one of them who believes that. But if 587 was the date of destruction of Jerusalem, and the Jews are saying it's the year 420 or something BC, which is way different completely. It's 150 years. It's called the 150 missing years. So we don't accept, maybe we should, but we don't accept everything in Jewish tradition. But certain things, like when they say Moses died on a Sabbath day, why would they be wrong about that? They would remember that. They were a faithful people. They remembered many different details about their history. And the date when, for example, the day of the week when Jerusalem was destroyed both times when it was destroyed, in 587 and also 70 CE, the day of the week for that, we can take the Jewish tradition at their word, I believe. But for many other things which are more doubtful, which are less verifiable or less simple to remember or simple to write down, you know, such as a date in chronology which you can't keep track of at the time, because there was no master time period calendar like we have today. We have the birth of Christ in 6 BCE, and the common era begins 5 years in a very short period of time after that, and that common era is the point from which we measure all of our dates, you know, back and forward in BCE and CE dates. Without that, how would we keep track of the dates? So the Jews didn't have that back prior to the Common Era. They didn't have this system of keeping the dating. So we can't be sure that they had any way of keeping track whatsoever of what the dates were when anything happened. That's why we don't trust or believe their dates. But, and we have that one example of 150 years that it, the their chronology differs from mainstream chronology. I mean, we're part of mainstream in some sense, in some cases, right? We're not generally part of mainstream. Like, we don't have to be mainstream in everything. That's important to realize, because you need to decide, is the mainstream correct or are they not correct? You know, that's what you need to figure out. Because in many, many cases, mature people decide that mainstream thinking is wrong, and they have to be individuals about it. But we have a time that we're talking about here in 1452 BCE when we've got lunar alignments around that time, as well as the lunar alignments around the time of 1493 of the Exodus, the time of the Exodus. Those lunar alignments are quite independent, but they're linked, they're connected by the 40 years and some months between the two, with the Bible telling us that Israel wandered for 40 years after the Exodus, before they entered the Promised Land. The rising of the sun is aligned also in 1014 BCE, which is the founding of the Temple of Solomon. That's from 1 Kings 6 and 1, which in his year 4, it says, in 1 Kings 6 and 1, and it also tells us it's the 480th year after the Exodus, or after they departed from Egypt, which therefore is 479 years after 1493, which is 1014. The, you know, the difference, let's do that just explicitly so that everybody can see it, including me. Let's say 1017, it's 1014, sorry, 1014. We could have said 1017 minus 3 because it was his year 4, but 1014 plus 479, 379, what is it, 479, yeah, 479, 1493, yeah. 1014 plus 479 equals 1493. So there's a connection between the founding of the temple and the Exodus date, and that's from 1 Kings 6 and 1. And that was also found by, it was found by Mr. Redinger. Irwin, I believe his name was, Redinger, that he found an alignment of the east-west axis of the temple with the rising of the sun in the year of the founding of the temple. But in his dating scheme, it was the lower date of the conventional chronology, which we reject. So we go for 1014 instead of the lower date, which he gives. We don't even care what it is, but it's some 46 years lower or something like that. So these are not difficult calculations, or not entirely. All right, and we've got a new astronomical program recently, too. It was phenomenal. SkyChart 4 has now become available for Mac, which is fantastic. It's 4.2 is available. I prefer the 4.0 version of SkyChart, but, I mean, it's a beautiful program that enables us to see the alignment of where the sun is on the horizon. And where it is at certain dates, such as Nisan 14 or whatever we're trying to align it with. I think Mr. Redinger aligned it with the 15th of Nisan, but that would be the Pharisees' Passover. We can align it with the 14th, which is the biblical Passover, or the date of the Sadducee Passover. Also, the Israelites. Okay, we presented all this material earlier in our earlier articles. That's something worth noting. We don't have to cover it all here. But the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 solar years and some months, as lunar dated from 1493. There's a lunar alignment of the first Sabbath day discussed in the Bible at Exodus chapter 16. And at the time of the accession of Thutmose III is when the Exodus date, 1493, is. But Thutmose himself didn't accede until many years later, of course. It's just that he backdated his accession to 1493, is what we believe. But his grandfather died in 1493. That's how that happened. At the Exodus, Thutmose I died by drowning in the Red Sea, is what is believed, according to what the Bible says about the Pharaoh being drowned, along with all the other Egyptians, when the waters of the Red Sea returned upon the Egyptians. That's Exodus chapter 14 and 15 in that time period in the Bible. And the, let's see, there's a full moon which is when they departed, very close to the date of May 1st. But the full moon waxing date, May 1st, in 1493, that's the night when Pharaoh's firstborn died. His firstborn son died in that year, 1493, according to our chronology, and in that year, that date of Nisan 14 would have been May 1st. According to the lunar calculations. So that works out nicely, May 1st. And it's also true that, well, traditionally also in the Egyptian ways of doing things, when a pharaoh died, particularly his next in line, typically his firstborn son would become the king upon the death of that one. But in this case, the firstborn of Pharaoh died on that night. And a new prince would come to be the heir apparent of the throne, right, on that night, May 1st. And that would be, eventually, it would turn out to be Thutmose II who would become king. So in a sense, he got the right to become king upon the death of the firstborn, who was very likely his brother, on that night, May 1st, when the firstborn of Pharaoh died, according to scripture again. So Thutmose II got favor on that night as well, right? Based on the fact that the heir apparent died on that night. And then very shortly thereafter, of course, Pharaoh himself died. Pharaoh Thutmose I. But Thutmose II, when he did become king, he was succeeded by his wife Hatshepsut. And Thutmose II didn't live very long. He ruled for only about 3 years, is what we believe, and then Hatshepsut became the pharaoh. She then continuing, as was customary for wives, by subsuming his accession date, while their young heir, Thutmose III, her stepson, was denied his rightful position. I think she would also be, she's also his aunt, because his father married all the pharaohs married their sisters, so his father married his sister. So the aunt of Thutmose III was also his stepmother. So, but her stepson Thutmose III was denied his rightful position because he was too young, of course, which he later took, which is the kingship, that is, of Egypt. And as was necessary, he subsumed their accession date, which he dated initially to his father's death, 1490. And we arrived at the father's death by using the well, we talked about it in other articles, and we'll have to cover it some other time maybe, but I think we've talked about it. I remember talking about it already. I'm not sure which article it was in, whether it was in Crucible or whether we mentioned it in this article. I'm not sure, but I'll look into that again. But we talked about how many scarabs were found for Thutmose II compared to the number of scarabs for his father, I believe, Thutmose I. And by comparing them, we could see that, you know, that the ratio of the number of scarabs that were found could be used as a way of determining how many years Thutmose II ruled, because we had no other way to determine it. So we determined it was this long. And then, you know, like 3 years, from 1493 to 1490, that was the rule of Thutmose II. That was from the date of the Exodus, and for 3 years after. And then Thutmose the III's stepmother, Hatshepsut, who was the wife of Thutmose II, began to rule, 1490. And I'm sure we have other reasons for believing that, because Thutmose III eventually took the throne I think he had to wait for the death of Hatshepsut, possibly. She didn't let him take the throne for a long time, even though he was evidently old enough, because she ruled for 22 years, I believe, something like that, 22 years, so he would have been plenty old enough to become king before she died, but he had to wait for her death, I believe, and then when he took the throne, he would have taken over her accession date, except she had subsumed the reign of her husband, who began in 1493, Thutmose II. So, when he initially, Thutmose III, knowing his father had died in 1490, he took 1490 as his year one. And the reason we know that is not just from the number of scarabs, but also from the lunar alignments of the recorded dates of Thutmose III up until the death of Hatshepsut. After Hatshepsut died, and in his later years, at least, we see that the lunar alignments indicate that his year one was probably 1493 at that point. So he had then subsumed the reign of Hatshepsut, which is also consistent with the fact that after he took the throne, he began to appreciate the way she had treated him, and he began to wipe out all traces of Hatshepsut from the monuments. And we believe then he adopted May 1st, 1493, the date of the Passover sacrifice, when a prince died, as his accession date, that became the accession date of Thutmose III. That's what we've adopted in our understanding of it. So, that's a lot to understand there, but how do we know that? That's the thing. Well, it's a simple theory. That's one reason why we want to believe it, that it happened that way. But, I mean, anything else, it's so simple that it makes good sense. Anything else would be unnecessarily complex. But we've explained this in this article, too, which chapter 2, paragraph 6, maybe we should look at it today, but I think you're going to be free to do that on your own. I think that I like to spend our extra time that we have talking about things that we don't otherwise get an opportunity to talk about. But if you want to read about it, you can read chapter 2, paragraph, well, even look, paragraph 4 and 5, actually, and even paragraph 3 talks about year 1 of Ramesses II, and how we arrived at a chronology for Egypt from 2774 BCE, which evidently was the beginning of the Egyptian calendar. And the year of an annular eclipse also over the Ark site. We have Narmer's palette with this amazing image of what looks like an eclipse there with the overlapping necks of these two animals with long necks, with the shape of the overlap being exactly circular, so as to indicate or imply an eclipse or something like that. Really interesting inscription, or it's a relief illustration on the Narmer palette, a very famous artifact of Egyptian history. Narmer having been one of the first, if not the first, reputed pharaohs of Egypt. I mean, and he may be equivalent to Nimrod, or the father of Nimrod, or something like that. We have so many interesting things we could study about the Narmer palette alone. It's fascinating. Oh, I remember some of the thoughts I had when I was researching this article. It was quite a beautiful feeling, you know, to discover things like the Narmer palette and to be able to look at it and just wonder in its beauty and its significance with the possible implication there of an eclipse. And then I didn't have time at the time. Back then I had no time to investigate things like this, but now I could maybe come back to it, or whenever we get time, we can come back to these things that we haven't had time for and discuss them, study them more, you know, consider them more, meditate on them, try and understand what the thinking was behind the person who made this illustration, and whether you know, whether we can then determine something more about what the significance of it is with regard to the dating. I mean, it's so exciting. The possibilities are so interesting. But I'm a multidisciplinary scientist. I study many different aspects of the ways of dating. You know, there are many different ways to date things. You know, the radiocarbon dating, when we were talking about that, I was remembering how we measured radiation. The half-life of radiocarbon, yeah, I didn't get to that. It's 5,730 years, but they don't even know the exact half-life of radiocarbon. They're estimating that. So maybe if they get a better, more accurate half-life of radiocarbon, and they know what the half-life is, then their answers for the radiocarbon dates will become more accurate. But of course, they're calibrating it using known tree rings of some kind of large pieces of trees that have been either very old trees, or pieces of wood that were from an earlier time that they match the dates found for the tree rings of those other pieces of wood. They do what's called wiggle matching, so they get the wiggle to match. If they can match the wiggle of one piece to the wiggle of another piece that has overlapping rings in time, if they overlap in the time of the dating, by matching the wiggle, they can say, well, this apparently is an earlier tree that overlaps in time with the later tree in terms of how we can build a calibration curve for the what's called dendrocalibration for the trees, right? So they use trees for calibrating all the radiocarbon dates, but so they don't really just use the value that they obtain from the radiocarbon tests, right, or measurements. They have to then calibrate using a graph, as I showed you before, using the dendrocalibration graphs. Well, it's in Chapter 8. We see that. An example. I should show that again, I guess, while we're on the topic. But I think the radiocarbon is so significant, and we've been learning a lot. Here it is. So the wiggle matching here, or there's no wiggle matching on these curves. The wiggle matching is done already by the people who create these calibration curves, but these calibration curves, I had to just resize them and then put them on the graph so that I could show what the calibration curve was that was used in each of these time periods. And there are three different calibration curve segments in each one in each time period here. There's one that's a little harder to see. That's the one of, I need to make this smaller. We couldn't see this yesterday, but here it is. Ramsey 2010, the orange calibration curve in the lower right. Yeah, there it is. It connects on to the blue one of BTAC, and then the blue one goes on to the lime green one of Manning. So these dendrocalibration curves are used in, given the radiocarbon date, which is before present on the vertical axis, given any number on the vertical axis, you then go horizontally until you intersect with the calibration curve, and then you go down to get the chronological date. That's how the calibration's done, okay? That's always how it's done. So I took a lot of these points, all of them, I believe, except for the one from Levy 2005, are from Bronk-Ramsey 2010 on this graph, as far as the data points, and they're shown as either rectangles or, apart from Levy's, which is a circle with an eyeball inside for Solomon's Mine, or Kerbet and Nahas, that is, but apart from that one, all of them are rectangles, either with white interiors or blue with a white square inside that. And the ones with the white square inside the blue are multi-lab tests, too. More than two multi-lab tests, actually, for those ones. So that would be this one. These two here, for example, that fall very close to the line. And this one that's not quite so close. Those are more than two multi-lab tests for all of those points on the graph. Radiocarbon is such a fascinating area of study, but we've seen that it's, well, we haven't actually studied enough to show in fact, most scientists, I mean, we haven't shown that radiocarbon is virtually useless by itself, but that's the truth. And people who have developed radiocarbon and who have studied it extensively know that radiocarbon has no real value on its own. You need a context, and you need to know when you think the sample dates, what the date of the sample really is, essentially, before you can get anything from the radiocarbon value, because radiocarbon values can sometimes be considerably different from what the actual date is, even after they're calibrated, you know, and put on a graph. They can be, for example, the city of Dor, I was saying, we've been studying that and seeing that at the city of Dor, the pottery for the Iron II time period was much underrepresented at Dor. And so it dated to 60 years later, but maybe it didn't appear till 60 years later, or the, because it was so underrepresented at Dor, where it was overrepresented at Riehof, or Tel Riehof. And so the chronology at Tel Riehof is 60 years higher at least. And the lab testing was done on the Riehof samples at Groningen in the Netherlands. That lab tends to give higher dates also, a little bit higher, but I'm not sure where they've redone all the tests at Dor to make sure. I mean, that's what happened when they got a value that was 60 years lower. everybody said you have to redo that because that can't be right, you know, but of course it stays the same when they retest it. So Dor just has this difference in the way the Iron Age dates for Iron II at Dor, at 60 years lower than the other cities. I mean, and that's, maybe we'll figure out more about that as time goes on, but that's the reality of it. So that's today's study. I think we've been studying radiocarbon because it's very interesting, and this is the blown up graph again of Radiocarbon Egypt's Archaeometric Logic, which is the title of the chapter we're studying right now. And you can see how much more detail is revealed in the zoomed in graph. And then we also show almost the first year one, according to Shaw 1550, on this graph. We show the Shaw dating for that king. In our chronology, almost the first is 1 or 2 years earlier than that. Not much different. And what else we got here? We got this graph. Oh yeah, there's this graph. Right. This was from Mazar, or maybe it's pronounced Mazer sometimes, names in Israel are pronounced like that. Sometimes I've seen it pronounced that way, but Mazer or Mazar, and Ami or Amahai is his first name. So we have in this graph, which is taken from some of the data he presented in 2008, we saw that the mid-Iron II fell right about here, the middle of that Iron IIa period, about 865 is the average of all the numbers, with a plus or minus 17 standard error of the mean, whereas the end of Iron I, 1065 plus or minus 11 standard error of the mean. That was the end of Iron I, and Shashak dates in our chronology to 973 BCE. The BG chronology. That's the end of the study for today, but it's just, I've been reviewing this graph. I keep looking at this graph. It's so interesting to me to show and to see, to understand how Shishak fits into this and explains how Shishak may well have been the reason for the change from Iron 1 to Iron 2, or a big part of it. Could have been all the destruction that he did in Palestine. So that's it for today. August 6, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 22:03 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you for watching and thank you for listening. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty and this is Cassie saying bye for now. We studied 9-4 of 9-3, what was it? 9-3 of Georgian War today.